Welcome, everybody, to the Boston Book Festival. Who's having, like, the best time today? That's the right answer. Thank you. And this is the past and present panel with our authors right here. So they're each going to read for less than it probably was planned for. And we're going to have a little discussion. And please get ready with some awesome questions. And the authors will provide the answers. First up, Ellen Herrick was a publishing executive in New York until she moved to London for a brief stint. She returned nearly 20 years later with three grown children, her own, it must be said. She now divides her time between Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a small Cape Cod town very much like Granite Point. Next up, Crystal King is the author of Feast of Sorrow, which was longlisted for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize. A culinary enthusiast and marketing expert, Crystal's writing is fueled by a love of history and a passion for the food, language, and culture of Italy. She has taught classes in writing, creativity, and social media at several universities, including Harvard Extension School and Boston University, as well as Grub Street. And my new friend, Julie Lextrom-Heim's short fiction has been published in the Shenandoah, Florida Review, 14 Hills, the Massachusetts Review, Mid-American Review, and elsewhere. Mikhail and Margarita is her debut novel. It was also shortlisted for the Center of Fiction's first novel prize, and she lives with her family in Marblehead. Welcome to all the authors. So we'll go in that order. How's that?
Okay.
Ellen Herrick will be reading from The Forbidden Garden.
Hi, thanks for coming out on a beautiful day, for being inside instead of outside. I always do this wrong. I think if I could just like... So I'm going to read from my second novel, The Forbidden Garden, which is continues the story of the three Sparrow sisters who I wrote about in the first book, The Sparrow Sisters. These sisters are kind of special. They live in a small seaside town. And they run a plant nursery, and each of them has a gift within that nursery. The oldest sister, Sorrel, has a real gift with flowers, and not just growing them and tending them, but arranging them. The middle sister, Nettie, has a great gift with food. So what she grows, she then cooks, and it seems to have a wonderful effect on the people who eat her food. And finally, Patience, the youngest, by quite a number of years, is a gifted healer with herbs and flowers and other tinctures and tisanes. So each of them takes from the garden what they are particularly good at and then gives it back to their community. So in the first book, you meet the sisters and you see how they interact in their community. In this second book, the focus is more on the oldest sister, Sorrel, who is the flower fairy. And she, after a lifetime of really caring for two younger sisters, finally gets a chance to travel away, to do something very different. In this case, she's been asked to go restore a Shakespeare garden in the countryside in England. And I'll just say that, you know, often when I write, I find that I'm homesick for whatever I'm writing about. So when I lived in London, I wrote about New England. When I moved back from London, I wrote about England. And there's a word, it's a Welsh word called hiraeth, which means, actually I'll just quickly read that definition, a homesickness for a home to which you cannot return, a home which maybe never was, the nostalgia, the yearning, the grief for the lost places of your past. So I'm a kind of a melancholy girl anyway. So That fits me well. So here I am reading from The Forbidden Garden, which was my way of dealing with homesickness for England. The garden waited. Behind the yew hedges, beyond the crumbling brick wall, within sight of the ancient house, under skies both heavy and light, the garden waited for someone to save it. Beneath the soil, now emptied of any nourishment, seeds huddled, asleep or worse, and still the garden waited. First, there were the birds that flew over and settled to pick at the bones of the garden. Then the small creatures dug and scrabbled until bulbs were gnawed raw and white. Finally, the larger animals came. Deer and dog, a lost soldier, shoes worn to paper, a farmer broken by blight. These animals were hungry too, their ribs pressed sharp against their fur, their fingers frost-tipped, their eyes as empty as the garden had become. Years passed with nothing to show in a land once so enchanted that bees and butterflies slept safe in the blossoms after their nectar was gathered. Here was a place that defined beauty in petals and leaves, scent and sight, hue and touch. Now, no matter the trowels pressed into the earth, the care taken with each tiny seedling, the garden would not wait. It was waiting for one pair of hands, one heart, one fine and tender soul to rouse it and release its magic. So Lord Hufflepuff, who owns the estate where the Shakespeare garden is, contacts Sorrel, the oldest sister, and says, come save the garden. He's quite canny about how much he tells her. He leaves out that the garden has been dead for almost 300 years, and that no one can figure out why, and that chances are it's cursed, and probably it seems to have an effect really only on women, and some of them die. So she says, right, I've got my password, I'm off, because he didn't tell her that. So off she goes, and her sisters are thrilled, and the sisters' boyfriends are thrilled. Everybody's thrilled, and Sorrel's a bit of a wreck. Leaving is not the same as running away, Sorrel thought, as she smashed shut the lid of her suitcase. Like her sisters, she was an infrequent traveler, so her luggage was not, unlike that of the rest of the world, on wheels. It was, in fact, her mother's suitcase, and was made of leather, worn smooth and shiny, not from use, but with storage. Sorrel had had a devil of a time finding the thing in the attic and then dragging it down the back stairs and across the hall to her room. She could have asked Patience and Nettie for help, but then she would have had to listen to their opinions again. She realized that a big reason that she had accepted the invitation was that she was tired of being one of three, or just one of three, Sparrow sisters. Sorrel needed to be herself and just herself, and now she would. It was the cusp of May, and Sorrel Sparrow had tidied away everything she could at work. The Sparrow Sisters' nursery had suffered that last summer just as much as Patience had, and it had taken weeks of cleanup and an awful lot of careful attention for the flowers and fruits, the vegetables and herbs to recover from the weather and the hurtful feet and hands that had come through tearing and grinding, stomping and ripping, until the nursery looked not so much like a paradise as a dark hell. Now, with the soil steaming in the early morning sun, Sorrel moved with the speed of necessity, as she set out flats of Shasta daisies, dusted peat moss from the dahlia bulbs before setting them into a bed, mulched the roses and the peonies whose deep red stems were leafing out, their tips hinting at the fat buds to come. The sisters were all gifted gardeners, so Sorrel wasn't terribly worried about her beloved flowers. Patience's herbs were in fine form, Nettie's fruits and vegetables were well on their way, and now Sorrel's blooms would have the best start they could without her capable hands to see them into June. With detailed instructions and many conversations, all that was left was for Sorrel to move forward.
I guess I just keep popping up. Next up is Crystal King.
There you go. All right, I'm a little shorter. So my novel is Feast of Sorrow. It's a book about the world's first foodie. Essentially. He was a man who has his name on the oldest known cookbook, a guy named Marcus Gavius Apicius. He's a real person. I recommend you don't Google him if you're going to read my book because it will spoil it for you. He traveled the world looking for the most luxurious ingredients for his feasts, and we know about eight things about him. Pliny the Elder writes about him, and one of the things that he tells us is how he died, which is in a really, really crazy way. And so I thought I'd tell the story of how he might have gotten to that point. We're going to start at the beginning of the book, and we'll just start there. Marcus Gavius Apicius purchased me on a day hot enough to fry sausage on the market stones. It was the 26th year of Augustus Caesar's reign. I was 19 and I'd been put up for sale at the slave auction at Baiae after 3 months under Titus Atilius Bulbus, a fat, swarthy beast I was glad I would never see again. I thanked the gods for the day Bulbus realized a good cook was worth 10 times his weight in denarii and decided it was more advantageous to sell me than to sleep with me. Mid-morning, the slave master, a heavy man with a barrel-shaped torso supported by bird-like legs, shuffled me toward an empty pen at the end of the slave platform. He brought a stool so I didn't have to sit on the dusty ground as two haggard old women scrubbed my naked body until not a trace of grime lingered on my skin. They trimmed my hair and they scraped off my beard, leaving me cleaner than I had been in months. From my bench in the new pen, I heard my future master before I saw him. "Ah, Master Apicius," the slaver said in a simpering voice, unlike the one with which he usually barked out commands at his slaves. "I'm glad you are here. I have two others inquiring about the cook, but I hoped you would arrive first." "Where is he?" Apicius asked, his voice a smooth baritone. There was a rustle of tent flaps and the slap of sandals as the hot stones. I scrambled to my feet as they rounded the corner and came into view. Apicius looked a decade older than me, with dark hair and an aquiline nose typical of a long Roman bloodline. An extraordinarily tall Egyptian man with wick black hair and biceps the size of ham hocks hovered in the background. I surmised he was Apicius' body slave, the personal attendant who accompanied him everywhere. The slaver opened the door to the pen and yanked me out to stand in front of Apicius, who took appraisal of my naked body, noting with his eyes that my head was bare. "No cap," he nodded his approval. The lack of a slave cap meant the fat slave master would guarantee me for 6 months. It also meant I was worth more. Apicius lifted the bronze plaque around my neck, freshly polished and etched with my credentials and history of ownership. I would wear it every day of my life as a slave. "Free of illness, does not steal. Good, good. Thrasius, eh? That's a Greek name." I nodded, unsure if I should speak. "You were the quocus to Flavius Maximus?" Apicius let go of the plaque and it slapped against my chest. "Interesting. I dined with Maximus a few months before his death. We had sausages of pheasant, sweet melon relish, and a patina of small fry. Was that your doing?" I gathered my courage and hoped my voice would not shake. I remembered that patina, an egg custard of which Maximus was quite fond. "Yes, that sweet melon relish was something new that I was trying." "How long did you work for Maximus?" "I ran his kitchen for a year before he died. He was fond of entertaining." My mind raced. Apicius was certainly interested in my cooking, but what if this man was as cruel as Bulbus? Apicius raised an eyebrow at me. "Can you make roasted peacock?" "Yes. I have a recipe for peacock with damson raisins soaked in myrtle wine. It works equally well with partridge or duck. I'm sure you would find the dish to your liking." I wiped the sweat off my brow. "What do you consider your specialty?" "There are three," I answered, raising my voice in order to be heard over the din of the market. "My ham and pastry with honey and figs has often been praised, but I have been told it is equaled by my truffles with pepper, mint, and rue. I can also make you a dish of roasted salt belly pork with a special mixture of garum, cumin, and lovage." Apicius smiled and started to ask another question, but the slave master was growing impatient. "The boy will make you famous," he whispered to Apicius. With him cooking, you will have clients and friends lining up in the morning begging for a spot at one of your canae, which is a dinner. He paused. Apicius glowed. The slave master continued. "His talents go beyond that of the kitchen. He can read and write. He is excellent at figures, and he speaks several languages. This is the quocus for you." "Famous?" The slave master cocked his head and smiled. "Most definitely." I expected Apicius to ignore the slaver's words. Yet he asked my price of the slave master, and the answer shocked me. 20,000 denarii. Slaves rarely sold for more than a few hundred denarii. "Sotus," Apicius beckoned to the body slave. Disapproval briefly flashed across Sotus' features as he stepped forward with a bag. Apicius opened the bag to reveal several golden aurei, then laid the heavy pouch in the slaver's dark, calloused hand. "The Argentari know me well," he said, gesturing in the direction of two men standing under a small canopy at the corner of the slave market. As representatives of the Roman bank, the Argentari were responsible for officiating over the larger sales, verifying credit, and making sure transactions went smoothly. "They will sign my letter of credit for the rest." The slave master grinned. He had profited heavily. I would later learn that my selling price was more than all the other slaves sold that morning combined. And so That's a little tease from Feast of Sorrow. Before I turn it over, I want to tell you just a little bit about the food of ancient Rome. There's a lot of really crazy stuff in here, including dormice, which they would fry up and eat whole, or flamingo tongues, which Pliny tells us that Apicius says are the most delicate flavor, or superb flavor. There is flamingo and peacock and all sorts of really crazy things. One of the delicacies was a sow's vulva after it had given birth, which we won't eat today, right? But we do eat a lot of things that are ancient Roman still today. French toast is ancient Roman. Foie gras is ancient Roman. Don't let any Frenchman tell you any otherwise, because the Romans did conquer Gaul. Haggis is ancient Roman. There's lots of dishes like tapenade, vermouth, and absinthe have their roots in ancient Rome. And there's just a lot of really amazing recipes that come in the Apicius cookbook. And I could not wait to start trying them out on my own. If you visit my website, there's a couple recipes there. And if you fill out the contact list, and tell me that you saw me at the Boston Book Festival, I will send you a copy of a recipe book of 25 recipes, including recipes from Barbara Lynch, Charles Draghi from Herbaluce, and Michael Pagliarini from Benedetto, as well as some food historians and Italian cookbook experts. Thank you.
And none of those things are available at the cafe. Going to guess. But all of the books are available, and they're right here. Wave-friendly booksellers, and the authors will be available to sign books, and there's nothing like getting your book signed. Think holiday gifts as well. Next up is Julie Lekstrom-Himes, and she will be reading from Mikhail and Margarita.
Thank you. So I thought I would begin by telling you a little bit about Mikhail Bulgakov. Today, Bulgakov is famous for his novel, The Master and Margarita. But when he lived and wrote in Moscow during the 1920s and 30s, he was actually known as a playwright, and in particular for a play called The Days of the Turbans. Now, this was an unusual play for its day. It portrayed in very sympathetic terms a family that supported the White Army during the Russian Revolution. Now, this was even more unusual because it was a huge success. It was a true hit of its day. And despite the efforts of the Repertory Commission, which was the organ of censorship at the time, it actually played for years. Stalin himself was a fan of the play, and it's documented that he actually saw it on 15 separate occasions during its run at the Moscow Arts Theater. Now, despite this, it's pretty much the only piece of Bulgakov's work that was ever produced during his lifetime. He was very well known, and he was commissioned to write more plays by some of the most famous directors of his day. In total, he wrote 10. But for the most part, that was the only one that was ever produced, and none of his short stories, his novellas, or his novels made it to print during his lifetime. Now, of course, he was hugely frustrated by this. But despite all of that censorship and that repression, he still continued to write. Now, in particular, he spent the last 12 years of his life writing The Master and Margarita. He considered it his masterpiece. At one point, he burned it and then went back and rewrote it from memory. After he died, his wife hid the novel for 25 years until after Stalin passed. It first came out in 1966. No one knew it existed. And when it was first published, it was as if a bombshell went off. The first 100,000 copies were gone within hours. Today, it's considered probably the Russians' most favored novel. It's been adapted for stage and film and television. It's been translated into all major world languages. Last year, Penguin Random House came out with its 50th anniversary new translation. But as at least one reviewer noted, it really should have been its 75th anniversary. So my novel, Mikhail and Margarita, begins with Bulgakov having dinner at the Writers' Union with his mentor and friend, Osip Mandelstam. And it begins with Bulgakov imagining that perhaps Mandelstam's lover, Margarita, might be someone that would become interested in him. He imagines stealing her away from his mentor. Later that evening, he meets Margarita in the restaurant, and then even later that evening, Mandelstam is arrested for a poem he's written about Stalin. So I thought I would read you a very short excerpt from within the book. Of course, there are two headliners in my title, and the excerpt I'm going to read to you is in the voice of Margarita, so you'll get to hear a little bit about the way she thinks. As I said, just so you have the context, later in the evening after dinner, Mandelstam is arrested. Probably another thing you should know is that Mandelstam's wife's name is Nadia, and she and Margarita were friends. One of the poems Margarita found at the Mandelstam's apartment had been written about her. She had kept it apart from those she had given to Bagakov. She recognized the early draft, different from the published one. It was an early version of his love. Reading it reminded her more sharply of its dissipation. They had taken risks in being together. She remembered a midsummer party at Nadia's parents' farm. She hadn't planned to attend, but he had insisted. Even if they couldn't be together, he wanted to be able to see her in that landscape. She remembered Nadia pretending not to know, or perhaps fortifying herself against it, and she likewise pretending. She remembered their embrace, the pressure of the other woman's arm against the back of her neck, their speaking of some childhood memory they shared as though they were actually talking about that. Osip approached them then, greeting her, slipping an arm around his wife's waist. Margarita blushed, and he beamed as though it was his doing. All seemed dangerously transparent. Later, when his visits to her apartment came less frequently, she sensed in him a recalculation of these risks. She remembered him telling the story of a former lover who had burned his belongings. He described looking down from his apartment one morning and seeing the clothes he had left with her, the books, a notebook, a few gifts, a flame in the street. He smiled as one who was mildly perplexed, yet not sufficiently bothered by the mystery to give it more thought. "I would never do such a thing," said Margarita. His expression was of muted skepticism. How could either of them know of what she might be capable under these unexplored circumstances? "Why did she hate you so much?" she asked. "I have no idea." He responded as if the thought itself was exhausting. How was it that this man, who could not commit a lie to the page, found it so easy to lie to her? Several months later, she would ask why he didn't simply break it off with her. Why not say the words, say he didn't want her anymore? He ran a finger up the length of her thigh. "Of course he wanted her," he said. He looked amused at her misery. "Who wouldn't want this?" he said, trying to push his finger through the fabric of her undergarments. She shoved him away, and he got up to leave. "What's wrong with you?" she said. He'd rather invite her hatred. He'd rather she set fire to his possessions. Somehow it was easier that way. Somehow he could go on writing poems about love. Thank you.
I don't want to block you, Crystal. Oh. Are you okay? Can everybody see everybody? Who has questions? I want to see how to gauge the time. Okay, we have no time. Okay, so we'll handle it. If you start thinking of questions at some point, give us a heads up and then we'll stop. So we'll have a conversation up here. This one is our panel is present and past. So I would ask each of the authors to talk about the way the past will inform the present in their books and the way the present will reflect and honor the past. And I guess you guys are sharing one mic. So share nicely.
All right. So my book is clearly set very solidly in the past in ancient Rome. And of course, in our political arena today, there's a lot of parallels. We see a lot of stories coming out about how, you know, the ancient Rome is very much like today, which I agree with in some ways. I think that there is still an incredible disparity between the rich and the poor, and probably even growing to this day. There was an incredible luxury when it comes to the wealthy in ancient Rome. Apicius was one of the wealthiest people in the entire country and maybe in the world at that point. And he spent it on all sorts of luxuries that the average Roman wouldn't be able to afford or even think about. And these luxuries were things like pepper and spices and access to meat. A lot of the peasants didn't even have meat to eat. They would eat grain that was rationed to them by Caesar in order to keep the peace. So there was a lot of, I think, parallels in that regard. I think that we are also, as a culture today, extraordinarily interested in food, very much like how Apicius was interested in food. And there are people that will travel the world looking for the best meal. And I think even within Boston, you know, there's definitely people that we're going to go find where they can get the best hamburger or where they can get the best and most incredible, luxurious meal. We seek out food and we love food. And the idea of food being at the heart of our politics, our relationships, our families, it's still the same now as it was then.
Thank you.
Well, I think, as I said before, I sort of write my way home. And in this case, although I studied history at college, it really had absolutely nothing to do with this book. But the research I did was mostly on what is in a Shakespeare garden. And there are gardens all over the country and the world that are Shakespeare gardens. And as I'm sure you probably know, they are filled with the flowers and plants and vegetables and fruits that are in all of his works, including his sonnets. And as I was feeling homesick for this sort of green and pleasant land of England, and I'm a keen gardener, but I garden by the sea, and the gardens in England, as you can imagine, are much lusher and much greener. And I suffer, I don't suffer, I think I perceive things almost as if I have synesthesia. In other words, things, eras have smells to me. Colors have smells. Smells have colors. So when I write about the past, that to me is a very real, real place. And the research that I did might have been very specific to this book, but immersing yourself in the past that way, and in a familiar past, in a way, with the landscape and gardening, I found was a really all five senses experience. And so when I write about it, I write it from all five senses. Usually smell is first. But, you know, the past is a real country to visit. And it's lovely to visit it, and then it's lovely to come back.
So I learned the story about Bogakov and the Master of Margarita from my father-in-law. He was a nuclear physicist, worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and often traveled to the Soviet Union and later to Russia to consult with them on their nuclear facility safety. And he came back from one of his trips and handed me the novel, The Master of Margarita. And he said they think of him as the Russian Garcia Marquez, which is a lovely description of his work. And so I read his work and loved the novel. And like a lot of us, flipped the book over to read about the writer and learned his story of how he was so heavily censored, and indeed his final masterpiece couldn't be published during his lifetime. And so I was tremendously fascinated by this, and I began the steps to do some research on this, thinking about the story and about the question of, why do we write? Why is it so important that we create art, that we're willing to go through all of these difficulties to the point of not even being able to have our voice heard, that we're still willing to do this? And in researching it, I went about it somewhat naively, thinking, oh, I'll just read about the Stalinist era, and that should be enough. And in reading about the Stalinist era, in reading about the people who lived at that time, so many of them believed in what their government was doing. They believed in the purpose and the opportunity for growth and make their country great. And so I thought, all right, I'm a Westerner and I'm not getting this. So I felt I had to go back even further in time to understand where they came from to bring them to that place. And ultimately I went back to the very beginning of Russian history, which is in and around 800 AD, and read forward. It seemed to me the only way I could actually get my arms around this very different culture. I think in terms of how it reflects on today, I finished the novel in the spring of 2015, so obviously before our current state of affairs, but there is, of course, tremendous parallelism in what was happening then with a culture that was, for the most part, 80% peasant, who then rose to be able to go and work in the cities and have those opportunities. And I think we're seeing some of that polarization now resetting itself in our own time.
What great answers. Who knew?
Just passing through. My book and my has really, there are no parallels. There's no message. This will not tax you or make you feel smart at all. You just dive right in.
She's so humble, I have to say. You will smell the past, you will embrace the future, and you'll want to plant a garden. And visit all of the author's pages on Facebook, follow them on Twitter. I don't know who's on Instagram or whatever, but one of the things in your readers that is really a wonderful thing to do, not only in reading and purchasing authors' books and supporting the independent bookstores, is the platforms that the authors are hanging out on. And to that end, what is your favorite place to promote and to share what it is that you're doing?
So I will confess, I'm one of those authors is guilty of not putting together a very robust platform. And I look at Crystal in particular, and because she has a wonderful website and a wonderful way of connecting with your audience. I think what has worked for me, what I'm so utterly grateful for, are my writer colleagues, my writer friends, who find different ways and different opportunities to help me promote my book in various venues. It's not just what the publisher has set up for me. I've done just as many of events just working with my fellow writer friends, and their support is just amazing.
It is an incredible community
of
writers. It is,
particularly this city.
Absolutely. Yay, Boston.
I too, am not terribly robust on my platform. In fact, I have forgotten the password to be able to edit it. So it's a real shame. But I like reading other people's. Actually, I enjoy Twitter. I particularly enjoy Instagram because, as Robin mentioned, I'm a gardener.
Amazing gardener.
And so I like to, and totally self-taught. So that gives me great pleasure. Mostly gives me pleasure to post pictures of the flowers or whatever I've grown and then have people come back with what they've grown. Or, and compare, my dahlias is your rubbish, but... they say dinner plate dahlia, and there's a picture of a little girl on the front of the seed, holding the dahlia next to her head, and it's bigger than her head. And so every year I wait for that
head-sized
dahlia. Yeah. So I post the biggest one I had this year. Oh, all these people came back with dahlias, big, big. So I clearly had dessert plate dahlias. But that is, I take great pleasure in the back and forth. Also, I have... very odd dogs, and so there's also that enjoyable back and forth. Very little discussion of writing goes on with me at all.
So I'm a social media professor, so I...
Have you met Julie?
I can help. I've always been an early adopter in technology and the web. I've been blogging since 1999, although I'm not the best blogger these days. You can find me more on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And I teach classes at Grub Street periodically, but definitely at the Muse, on social media and for how authors can use social media and not be annoying. Because, oh my gosh, authors can be so annoying on social media. My goal is to actually connect with people and have conversations. And one of the things that I love the best is when I have those networks and I meet people and I meet authors in social, and then I get to meet them in real life. And I think there's somebody in the audience right now that I have not met in real life, but we only know each other in social, and I'm so excited to finally meet her. So
She must look like her picture then.
She does.
That helps. And who am I, you might ask, because I didn't have an intro. So I decided to give myself an intro, unless Ellen, you'd prefer.
Robin is
amazing.
Yeah. No. She's my fairy book mother, but not just mine. She's everybody's. And I first met Robin in a Muse thing where this text popped up, and my book was my first book, The Sparrow Sisters, was just a galleon. I was so undone and overwhelmed by this conference thing. And this text pops up, and she goes, "Hi, I'm Robin. You don't know me. But you want to have coffee? I'm right downstairs." And I look over the balcony, and she's like, So that's how I met her. What she does is she takes, you know, to stretch that metaphor to breaking, she opens her wings, she scoops you in, she introduces you to other wonderful writers who then open their wings. She gives you venues. She's the curator of the Point Street Reading series, which is every third Tuesday.
Yes.
Nice.
Good
every
job.
Third Tuesday of the month, where you hear people read and talk and laugh. And it's like being in your dorm room, you know, freshman year when you finally found your besties and you all got together and just sort of sat around on the floor. And then she does way more formal things, like upcoming on this Wednesday, the 1st, is her evening with authors, which benefits breast cancer research and care. And she has really big stars. And last year I did it, and I was not one of the stars. There were three of us. It was
yes, Alexander you were a star.
Alexander Chi and Wally Lam.
And Ellen.
And they talked about process. And I said I made things up. And she, you know, she was like, yes, you do. Good for you. Good for you. You know? So Robin she's the essence of caring for writers who are not always so good at caring for themselves.
Oh, I just really meant you could say Reading with Robin has a podcast.
Oh,
thank you. That was beautiful. And that was not set up. Thank you. Because when I got the details, I was like, well, who's introducing me? And the answer was just go and introduce the authors. So I would be remiss in not doing that. What do you do? How much time do we have? We have this. Anybody have a question? Because I'm supposed to open it up. A question. And a microphone is coming your way. Yes, a microphone.
Questions for Jill. How much deep research could you do on Mikhail himself rather than just the history of how he evolved into a writer and what his life was really like? Did you have access to primary sources? And I've always been a little skeptical, like fictional biography, and yet with good research, you can really give a good representation of who he was. Did you have access to that?
So I think there are a lot of interesting opportunities for researching him specifically. There are a number of collections of his letters that he kept. He very early on kept as well a journal, but the first time his apartment was ransacked by the police, the secret police, he ceased to keep a journal. Interestingly enough, though, he did ask his third wife, who was his model for his Margarita, to keep her journal. And so hearing her voice and her words, and she sounds like this amazing woman that you would want to be friends with. So reading his letters, reading her journal, entries help create a picture of their home life and their relationship, as well as his frustration with the publishing industry, with the theater industry, with the government itself, the many letters he wrote to Stalin and to the Soviet government. It was very illustrative of the way he thought. I think the other thing to consider about his novels, The White Guard, The Dead Man's Memoir, The Master and Margarita, is that they were in some ways autobiographical in terms of you could sense as a writer reading his work, you could sense so much of the author himself making very plain what his concerns and his interests were, which is incredibly helpful. The one work that he did write that was meaningful to me in a very personal way is The Country Doctor's Notebook. He was a physician before he became a writer, and his first year out of medical school, he worked in the wilds of Russia in a very lonely clinic with just him and a nurse, basically taking care of hundreds of patients a day. And reading his short stories, which were all written in first person in very, very plain, open language, it would have been like rereading my own journals as a young resident. It was just I immediately connected with that voice because it was very open about his fears, his hopes, his concerns, the things that scared him as a young doctor, the things he didn't know. And so for me, that really, I felt like I had his voice at that point.
Any other questions? Somebody else had their hand up. No? Oh, question.
I'm already here. You're good.
Just a quick question for Julie. If someone was going to read Master and Margarita as a companion to your book, Should they read it first or afterward?
That's a question I haven't gotten yet. I wrote my novel so that it would not be necessary to read The Master and Margarita. They're very different books. His is a book of magical realism. Mine is very much realism. I don't think it really matters, frankly. I think that I would say that it doesn't really matter. Definitely, I did not write the book so that it would require the reading of his first, but I think either order would be fine. That's, give it.
It's a good one. And what are you reading? That is, I mean, everybody likes to know what the authors are reading, or what are you blurbing that's coming? And are you reading the companion book as well, Ellen? Yes.
I'm back. What am I reading? Well, I read constantly and widely. And a lot of writers will say they can't read while they're writing. I can't write if I'm not reading. I mean, you need, I just need other voices and I need other stories. And I want somebody to say to me, come. I'm going to tell you a story. Because that makes me able to do that. So I read everything from really, really good stuff and not serious, but, you know, proper book, like Celeste Ng's new book, Little Fires Everywhere. Then I read this really great book that I'm sure no one will ever read called Magicians Impossible, which is about what if it's like book. James Bond meets, wizards. So all these spies, it's spy versus spy, but they all have magic abilities. So I'll read something like that. Then I just read the E. Lockhart Genuine Fraud, which is sort of The Talented Mr. Ripley backwards. I'm about to start The Last Mrs. Parrish, which is supposed to be fabulous. Yeah. So yeah, I read everything. Cereal boxes.
So recently I read The Underground Railroad, I loved. And I'm in the midst of Commonwealth and also The Mystery of Utmost Happiness, which I'm just loving that language. It's beautiful.
Oh, gosh. I read so many books that I'm thinking, which book should I talk about? And then all the names are escaping me, of course. I think I'm on book 84 of this year, so I read pretty quickly. Some of my favorites this year, the new book by Emily Hauser, which the name is failing me, but her first book is called The Four, The Most Beautiful. The second novel, which I can't remember the name, but Emily Hauser, and it's about the myth of Atlanta, of Jason the Argonauts. Her first book, For the Most Beautiful, is about the three muses and the golden apple, and she's a local writer as well, and her books are beautiful. What else have I been reading? I've got so many books.
This is the one question I usually.
I wish you had asked me before. I got to.
I know. I just wanted to see if stump the authors. What are you reading? I know that happens.
Yeah, all of them have gone out of my head. It's like I'm on book 84 this year. So, yeah.
Check your website.
Yeah, it was good.
I know, right? Go to Goodreads. You can see my list.
Exactly. How are we doing for time? We're still okay. What do you do if you should ever get stuck with your writing? What's something that's a good sort of unblock? I'm sure there are a lot of writers in the audience that might want to know too.
I've never had writer's block, thank God, but maybe it's because I do the right thing. There's two things that I do that help me a great deal. And one is that when I'm driving, I will put on classical music in the car and I will talk to myself and I will walk through, what if this character does that? What might happen? And I literally just answer myself, and I have this whole conversation. Everyone at stoplights thinks I'm insane, I'm sure, but I've worked out so much of my books that way. And then the other thing I do is when I go to sleep at night, I think of what's going to happen in my next scene, I have solved big chunks of my. Either I go to sleep really fast because I'm bored with my own story, or I figure out big pieces of it. And when I'm in between books, I get really crazy because I don't have anything to think about while I'm falling asleep. It's really sad.
Well, I could just say I nap, which is true. I say to my husband, I'm going to have a little lie down.
How long can those last?
Oh, like hours. If the dog comes up, hours. But in truth, I often do what you do. Is I'm falling asleep, I'll start to work things out. I don't plot because I don't know how. So I sort of tell myself the story as I'm writing it down. So if I'm lying around at night and can't sleep, I'll do that. And the other thing I do is, again, I read. Sometimes I'll reread authors I really love. For instance, Lori Colwin is someone I go back to all the time because her writing is lovely, her dialogue is snappy, and she makes me feel so comfortable because I'm in good hands. So sometimes that's what I need to do. I need to read somebody who's really good at what they do. And oddly, that sort of gives you you think, oh, it's like a big deep breath. Oh, okay, onward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I agree with you. That's where I go first when I'm having trouble getting the words out on a page is I'll go to a writer who usually I've read them before, but it's just putting the right, good, strong words back in my head really helps unlock my own head. And then the other is an exercise I learned from one of my favorite teachers is Margot Livesey, and I know she's giving one of the sessions here on dialogue, I think. Yeah, she's a wonderful teacher. But she taught a exercise, and I don't think she invented this, but it's called the I Remember, where you just sit down and start with I Remember and recall some event from your own life and just write a few sentences about it. And doing it a few times can really, again, just kind of unlock things and open up the mind.
Thank you. I was given the last question signed, so that was it. The authors will be over here signing, and books are for sale. And thank you all for coming. Enjoy the rest of the day.